My name is David Levy-Fall. So our first speaker for today's panel is Yannis Grigoriadis from Bilkent University, Ankara, minority rights in Greece and Turkey. 15 minutes, Yannis. Thank you.
First, thank you for being here today. I'd like first to thank Kaifye and Sapanji University for their invitation. My paper will refer to Europeanization of minority rights in Greece and Turkey, and I think this comparison makes sense because we're talking about a case of Europeanization at the gates of EU membership in the process of EU accession, and the case of Europeanization within the borders of the European Union. Greece has become a member of the European Union back in the early 1980s. At that time, there were no conditionality requirements linked to minority rights in the country. So this meant that significant minority rights persisted. However, in the 1990s, there have been significant reforms in the field of minority rights, which were linked with the influence of the European Union in Greek politics. At the same time, I would like to focus on what has changed in Turkey as far as minority rights are concerned over the last 10-15 years, and I would like to draw some conclusions from these two processes as far as how conditionality policies should be implemented in the future and what needs to be done within the European Union for this conditionality to be more efficient. So, as I'm writing on the slide, there has been an asymmetry led, which exists because of the absence of the Copenhagen criteria for previous member states. So countries like Greece were allowed in without really a sincere reform of their minority rights legislation. There have been significant problems which were actually addressed at the European Court of Human Rights. And there are still some problems. I'm not arguing here that the issue is completely resolved right now. But the situation in Greece is significantly better than in the early 1990s and also significantly better than in Turkey right now. So I would identify two waves of minority rights reforms in Greece. In 1990, in 1993, 1996, and 2000, this first wave is linked with the Mitsotakis government, which raised the question of minority rights in Greece for the first time. And when I refer to minority rights, I should have mentioned it from the beginning. I mainly refer to the Muslim Turkish minority of Western Thrace, because Greece, until the arrival of immigrants, has been a rather homogeneous society due to the population exchange with Turkey and all the events that led to the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. So this was the single most important minority in the country. So in the early 1990s, there have been major initiatives linking to the partial recognition of minority rights in Western Thrace. There has been a campaign of the state named Legal Equality, Equal Citizenship. There has been the lifting of travel restrictions. It was really difficult, even until the end of the 1980s, to visit these areas. These were Cold War limitations that survived in many parts of northern Greece, but Western Thrace was the last part where these limitations existed until then. And there have been attempts to promote economic development of the region as well. Same time, of course, these attempts were meant to change the image of Greece within the European Economic Community, European Union. Greece, thanks to the policies, to a large extent, of the Papandreou, the first Andreas Papandreou administration, had become like the black sheep, the Bête Noire of Europe in many respects. So there has been an attempt to, in a way, correct that very negative image. A similar attempt of a major significance was also undertaken by the Simitis administration in the late 1990s. And this is the second wave of minority rights reform which I referred to. And this was a part of a greater reform agenda. And this, I think it's more interesting for us because, in a way, there was an attempt to reshape Greek national interest and reshape Greece's identity within Europe. So the main point that was that Greece should be the European country of the Balkans and not a Balkan country in Europe. So in that respect, it should cease being a kind of a problem case within the European Union, but should be a country which should help diffuse European norms and values in a very difficult neighborhood. A key case for this reform was the abolition of Article 19 of the Greek Citizenship Code, which was undertaken in famous dimensions until the 1990s. Actually, this article differentiated between Greek citizens of Greek and not Greek descent. And practically, it worked against the Greek constitution by allowing administrative authorities to strip Greek citizenship from non-Greek origin Greek citizens who had left the country without an intention to return. So this article allowed for the stripping of Greek nationality from thousands of minority members who actually emigrated to Turkey, Germany, or even paid short visits outside Greece. So it was a major issue. Of course, the issue was struck by the Council of Europe, so there has been a major initiative emanating from that institution, but it had already attracted attention within the European Union. So the Smitis administration had kind of underline that this issue is causing us so much harm in our image as a European country that all sorts of kind of perceived benefits shouldn't be considered. So he was using a double language in that respect. He was also appealing to the nationalist core of his own party, like the Socialist Party, Social Democratic Party, but he also used a kind of like, say, more constructivist understanding of Greek national interests. So kind of presenting Greece as a European country in the Balkans was very appealing to another part of his clientele. Problems still exist. As I said, the situation is not clear. It's not perfect today. There have been cases as far as religion freedom is concerned. There is a dispute about the right of muftis to be elected in Western Thrace. That's a very interesting controversial issue because muftis are not elected in Turkey either. So they're state appointed, so Turkey is kind of, but of course from a kind of pure religious freedom perspective, it's a very interesting case. On the other hand, that's what's very important to understand here is the legacy of the Lausanne Treaty, which is a kind of Sharia almost linked legacy. So these muftis enjoy judicial rights within like European territory. So they are responsible to deal with family law affairs of the minority members. So this issue hasn't been really debated and discussed. And although the thing is that many, of course, female, women face enormous discriminations in these courts because they practically implement Sharia law, these women may have the right to appeal to the civil, Greek courts, but then they may face enormous sanctions from the society. So the minority, at the village level, it might be very difficult for them to escape this situation. Another issue which is still very important is the ban of the use of the term Turkish in associations based in Greece. So there have been cases brought to the European Court of Human Rights whereby Greece was found violating the European Convention of Human Rights on this, but there has been significant resistance at the level of the High Court, which is kind of similarity with the case of Turkey. So even if politicians may appear to be more willing to shift from these rulings, like in some cases, even courts appear to be major obstacles. Moving to the case of Turkey, I won't spend much time on this because time is limited and you've already heard listened to papers about Turkish minority rights. There have been severe cases of human rights violations throughout the history of Republican Turkey. And I refer to the recognized and non-recognized minorities, so Greeks, Armenians, and Jews were recognized in the Lausanne Treaty, so they enjoyed some status, but even this status was kind of undermined by persistent state policies. Other minorities like the Kurds, the Alevis, like the Syrians, the Arabs, the Laz, they haven't been there, so they faced denial even at this point. I would identify a low point in the 1980s under the Kenan Evren regime, the Junta regime, which brought human rights violations for Turks and non-Turks, but minorities to a large extent, faced more threats. And that's the time when Kurdish language was even banned, so it was illegal to speak Kurdish in Turkey. Of course, in the case of Turkey, you have the Copenhagen criteria, which form a different frame as far as the promotion of minority rights and Turkey's European membership ambitions were concerned. We have the key decision of the European Council in Helsinki, which is a seminal moment, especially for Greek-Turkish relations, because Greece kind of undoes its long-standing policy of being an obstacle to EU-Turkey relations, and in a way supports Turkey's EU application process under the condition of parallel improvement in bilateral relations. So the idea is that European Turkey may be a better neighbor and a better partner, a country which can easier solve bilateral problems with Greece. So there is a comprehensive reform process. I won't spend time on this because of lack of time, but I'd like to highlight the rise of a new debate on inclusive definitions of Turkishness. And I refer to the CAP report, which appeared some like 7 years ago by a committee led by Ibrahim Kavolu and Baskun Oran professors, who tried to identify a version of Turkishness which was civic and inclusive rather than ethnic. So they suggested the term Türkili, which means from the Republic of Turkey, rather than Turk, which has an ethnic, clear ethnic connotation. So the term Türkili would appeal to Kurds, Armenians, Greeks, Alevis. So this was understood as an inclusive definition, which of course faced a lot of reaction. Actually, this report was at the beginning requested by the government, but then the government tried to take distance from this report. So in a way, they saw that it would cause them a lot of trouble. There has been a significant deceleration of the reform process since 2005. And I think this refers to minority rights as well. And there has been a lot of back and forth as far as the Kyrgyz issue is concerned. Like, and I think this was reflected somehow in the previous panel. On the one hand, there is a state Kurdish language channel which has been launched, but on the other hand, we have trials against Kurdish municipal leaders, and you have a lot of rising tension between the AKP and the Kurdish party of Turkey, DTP, BDP today, after following the ban of the party, of course, another milestone as far as violation of human rights are concerned. So I think it's interesting to see, like, we can't spend much debate time on this, but it's interesting to see how you follow Turkish electoral dynamics, that the only two parties in southeast of Turkey is the AKP and the Kurdish party. So in that respect, a lot of this debate may be understood in terms of domestic political competition. So it's, of course, I can't elaborate on this right now. Quickly, I can refer to some of the problems of the Greek minority. I refer here to a success case, an orphanage building in the island of Büyükada, which was confiscated by the Turkish state in 1994. This has just been returned to the Greek community, which was a big, like, success. And it was returned to the Greek community. Even a bigger success was that the Turkish state could have practically paid a compensation for this and kept and could keep this building, but it preferred to give this same building back. And the second element of success was the fact that the owner of the building appeared to be the patriarchate. Like, until recently, even the legal status of the ecumenical patriarchate would face a lot of opposition by the Turkish authorities. So it was a big success. There are other issues which exist, and I won't spend time because we don't have it, like the ecumenical character of the patriarchate. Yes. The seminary in Heybeliada, the religious seminary, which is still closed. If I'm coming to my conclusions, since I have 2 minutes, I think that we can use rationalist and constructivist arguments regarding Europeanization, as if we want to understand what changed in Greece and Turkey. In the case of Greece, the Tsimikas government recognized the need to reconfigure Greek national interest, citizenship, an identity on a more constructivist basis. So it was able to change these long-standing definitions of national identity and to mitigate the threat about Greek national interest emanating from this change of the Article 19. So as you can see on the slide, he kind of used also rationalist arguments in order to maximize domestic support. If we come in the case of Turkey, constructivist arguments, I think, fare better. And Turkish political elites understood that these radical reconfiguration of political and social norms could actually support Turkish stability in the long term. And these allowed for the rise of novel definitions of national identity, as the Türkiye'lilik case. However, as I said, this process lost steam as far, together with many other aspects of Europeanization in Turkey in the last term. So, a last point I would like to make is that it's important for European institutions, if they want to promote social learning in candidate states, is to look into what's happening within the EU. So, to maintain a strong effect of conditionality, European institutions should develop instruments to secure compliance with European norms throughout the European Union. So even the slightest problem of Turkish Muslim minority in Greece kind of undermines very strongly the case for minority rights reform in Turkey. Thank you.
Thank you very much.